Thanks for listening to The Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook, / The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter, at The Kick-Ass Life, and, of course, at thekickasslife.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Joe Vitale, author of Attract Money Now. You're listening to The Kick-Ass Life Show with David Wood.
Life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the show. It's a beautiful blue sky day out here up in British Columbia, Canada. The snow is glistening. It's a little crunchy under feet, and it's just a gorgeous day. Gorgeous day to be alive. And every day is, by the way. I'm really excited about my guest today. My guest is very, very special. But before that, I just want to let you know what I'm up to. Obviously, I just got back from an amazing weekend up in the mountains, and I sort of took you along with me and sort of made this show a little bit late. So I'm a little bit late today because I'm falling behind a little bit this week as we rev up for the trip to Africa. And prior to that, I'm off to St. Martin, actually, in the Caribbean. I'm having a meeting with the TLC, the Transformational Leadership Council, started by Jack Canfield and, you know, some amazing people are members of that, you know, John Assaraf and John Gray and Marcy Shymoff and Mike Dooley and Lisa Nichols, all these people from The Secret, Joe Vitale, just so many, Dave Wagner, you know, there's so many great people. And so twice a year we get together and hang out, people who do this kind of work, and I'm really excited about that. And then heading straight from the Caribbean, straight to Africa to hike Kilimanjaro. And, you know, I was reading today the interesting things about Kilimanjaro. You know, it's about 8 people a year do die on this hike. And typically it's heart attack or it's to do with altitude sickness. But I mean, it's a serious thing, 19,340 feet. And, you know, as we're preparing ourselves, we know it's not the climb up the mountain. It's the climb up the internal mountain. And they say it really is about that sort of internal journey, like most experiences are. So I'm really, really excited to be going and obviously taking it extremely seriously. I'm heading up a small team, but there's going to be 21 of us going. And I'm just very, I'm excited. I'm open. I'm ready to learn and grow. And that's really the mindset of going there. I have no attachment to the top. I know that can be a very dangerous thing to think you have to be at the top. You know, we'll do the best we can, and I'm sure that if we play our cards right and we do what others have done before us, and we learn the lessons that they've learned, that we can do a good job. But altitude sickness is really interesting. I read the article this morning which was talking about, you know, the fittest people actually are not the ones that normally make it. It's the people who are not as fit. And the reason is because they walk more slowly. Isn't that interesting? And they acclimatize more slowly. So someone who's really fit, they just can't walk slowly, slowly. And apparently one of the big calls on the mountain is pol-pol, you know, which is slow it down, slow it down. And so, you know, with that said, I'm really excited about my guest this week, and because she's all about that internal mountain. I'll give you a little song to help you identify what her background is. See if you can guess. Here we go. If you guessed the Olympics, you'd be right. This woman, she's so accomplished. And she's an Olympic swimmer. She had 4 gold medals in major international competition. She's 7 years on the USA national team and co-captain of the US national team. She has records in the American, US Open, Italian Open, and the Australian Open. And, you know, and she, like most people who do this kind of achievement, you know, she's turned this into something pretty amazing. And she really does help people bring the best out in themselves. But what was remarkable about her story, and you're going to find out in a few minutes, is that she didn't just stay at the top. Life is all about peaks and valleys, and it's really how you are in the valleys. And her book, Be Your Best Without Stress, Be Your Best Without Stress, is one of her contributions to mankind. And as you listen to her story, you'll listen that, you know, she really had to overcome major obstacles after her success, as she her health plummeted into a place where she never expected to go. And it's she overcame some incredible mountains in her own mind. Let's listen in as I have a great chat with my guest, Katrina Radke. So I always start the show by saying how excited I am, and here I am again. It's coming out of my mouth. I'm so excited. And today our guest is she's remarkably accomplished, and I just so excited to hear this story of the peaks and valleys of success, and how, you know, how to get these sort of outcomes we want in our lives. So first, I just want to welcome you, Katrina, to the call today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you know, and I want to take you back right away. I mean, your story's new to me. You know, you and I just getting to know each other, and you know, I want to take you back to the Olympics, and because I know so many people who work so hard to get there, and here you are. You're a young girl, and you're on the starting blocks at the Olympic Games in Seoul, in Korea. Take me back to that moment. How did that feel? What was going on for you?
Well, to be honest, it's funny, and it sounds so small, but it's just another pool. And so in many ways, I was just going through my normal routine. And I know people think, oh, gosh, the Olympics, all this media, and we see everything on TV, and it seems like this grand event. And it is a grand event. It's so wonderful. You know, my favorite memories of competition in general are something internationally where we got to compete against all different countries and see what they're, you know, even if we couldn't speak the same language, we could actually still, you know, communicate through nonverbal ways. And so to be honest, behind the blocks, I had my normal routine. I wrote about this in my book too. In chapter one, I share a little bit about what I do behind the blocks. And that was making sure I had my two sets of goggles, my two cassettes of caps in my parka pocket. And then, you know, going behind the blocks, putting my hands on the block and feeling the roughness of it. And then clapping my hands and feeling the wetness of the water on my feet. And then when the starter says, you know, basically they whistle and you get up on the blocks. And I curl my feet over the edges, and I was doing a two-footed start at that time. Most people nowadays do a track start where one foot's forward, one foot's back. And I love looking at the water and seeing the crystal blue clarity of it and knowing I have my own little lane, and I pretend like my light had like shine out, you know, lit all up with light, and I get myself into my starting position, and then they say, take your marks, and I get ready to go, and my mind's usually, it's very quiet, and then I beep, go.
Up to that point, how many hours do you think if you were guessing how many hours you spent in the pool, how many times you'd you'd gone up and down a pool, how many hours do you think that was?
Oh gosh, I've swam around the world, I know that by the amount of miles I've done at least once, and not twice. And I know when we were training, when I was at my peak, you know, I was training 6 days a week for about 5 hours per day, and then of course I'm still doing visualization and other things beyond that. And so, gosh, I have never added up how many hours it's been, but that'd be an interesting project.
Well, I mean, when I look at your resume, you know, co-captain of the U.S. swim team, you have records in America, in Italy, Australian Open, 4 gold medals in major international competitions. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of accomplishment there. And I want to go back to even further when you first started out. How old were you when you first sort of got that bug? Were you tiny, or when did that bug hit you?
Well, it's so funny, you know, because as I was mentioning, my husband and I have 2 children now who are 6 and 7, and people ask us, were they swimming since they were 1? And I say, no, we let them be kids. And luckily I grew up in a small town here in Minnesota called Morris. And we had a beautiful 25-yard pool there. And I grew up, I have 2 older brothers who were 4 and 5 years older than me. And so I just wanted to be wherever they were. And they were starting to swim as well as play with their buddies outside. And I would just kind of try and tag along as best I could. And, of course, me being 5 years younger than my oldest, you know, sometimes he didn't really want a little girl hanging around. And so I had to do my best to be able to keep up. And so the same thing happened in the pool, basically, is I remember going to the pool when I was about 6 and a half. And at that point, we had a summer pool that we would all, you know, many people would go to in the town. And I would play in the water like anybody from like 3 to 7 years old. But I really didn't, I took some lessons. I remember passing and being able to swim my first length, probably around 6 years old. And then at 7, I was actually put onto the swim team. And I remember being so afraid to go down to the deep end. I was like, oh my gosh, there might be sharks down. It was kind of dark. And so I just remember like literally hanging on to the side of the wall, being like, I'm not sure I want to go down there because it's deep. And I don't know what's down there. It was like, well, even though the pool was really clean. So, you know, obviously I got over my fears over time went on. And but it's kind of funny, you know, you look back, it's not like I had, you know, like you hear some stories about athletes who were like three and their parents were saying they were destined to be this great athlete. And no, I was like a normal kid. I did gymnastics and softball. I ran and, you know, I just did what, you know, did everything. And luckily my family was very active. And so we just, you know, played like normal kids for a long, you know, till age seven, eight, nine. And I remember when I was in third grade, we were given an assignment that said, you know, when I am 25, dot, dot, dot. And we had to finish the sentence. And I found this, like, when I was about almost 25, actually. It was kind of funny. In a scrapbook, it said, when I am 25, I will have gone to the Olympics, won many medals in swimming, then I'll get a boyfriend, coach for a couple of years, and then get married.
Is that what happened?
Pretty much. I mean, it's kind of funny. At the time, I was in graduate school, and I was very serious with a different person, but I was coaching in graduate school, and yeah, it's like, wow. I mean, it just kind of sometimes makes you wonder what you put out there in your conscious mind and create this intention out there in the world and then kind of let go and not worry about it too much. Things do happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had a really fun, interesting journey being able to be on the U.S. team for 7 years.
It's funny, you know, John Assaraf is coming back on our call. He wrote the book, The Answer. And he's the guy, I don't know if you know his story or not, but he's the guy that he had a vision board and he put a specific house on his vision board and he put it away and it's, you know, they moved house and it stayed in a box for, you know, years. And one day they bought a house and they pulled out the vision board and it was the identical house that he'd taken out of a catalog or a magazine. So it's incredible how powerful that is, right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. You see it show up in many people's lives, right?
Yeah. So anyway, so here you are. You're kind of a normal kid, great family. Obviously, you know, the sounds like a lot of love there. And then you find a passion and you excel at it in an amazing way. And I want to ask you, before we move to this next chapter of your life, which again, you mentioned your book, Be Your Best Without Stress. And I really want to get into some of the nuggets in that book so we can help some people out who are listening around the world. But, you know, before we get into that, that next chapter, which is one of the valleys maybe, which probably will turn out to be a peak. What was the highlight of your whole swimming career? Can you think of a moment where you think, wow, this is it? This is the sort of the cherry on the cake of everything I've done.
Well, to make an Olympic team was one of the biggest cherries on the cake. But before that, when I was 14, I made my first international trip. And it was 1985. And it was the year after the Olympics, the Los Angeles Olympics. And I made the Olympic team. I made that team. It was called Pan Pacific Games. And I was on the team with all these Olympians from 1984. And, you know, back then, compared to now, most people were lucky to be able to swim in one or two Olympics because there was no funding or extra money. And a lot of girls were not able to swim in college even. And so it was very rare for them to even be still swimming. So I was on a relay, a 4x200 freestyle relay, with two Olympic gold medalists. One of them was like one of my idols I had been watching on TV since I was like seven. And so it was, I remember getting on the bus, we were going to Tokyo, and we're getting on the bus to go to the airport, I should say, to Tokyo, and Mary T. Maher, who at the time was the world record holder in the 200 and the 100 meter butterfly, who was just like, you know, light years ahead of everybody else, and the most gracious, wonderful lady, she came and sat next to me, and I was like, oh my, it was like, you know, imagine like some kids nowadays would go, oh my gosh, Michael Phelps is coming to sit next to me, and he's actually talking to me, it'd be like that kind of experience, and anyhow, she sat next to me and just started talking to me like a normal person, asking my name. We started talking, and, you know, it was a surreal experience. And I ended up writing about it in my English class that following year because I ended up realizing that she had hopes and fears just like I did and that she was a human being just like I was. She happened to swim a lot faster at that time than I did. But ironically, she ended up being my main competitor in 1988 for the 200-meter butterfly. And I would have never known at age 14 that was going to happen. And so it was really an eye-opener to see because, you know, oftentimes as a society, we're taught to put people up on a pedestal, whether they're the president of the United States or a CEO of a company or the Olympic gold medalist or whatever it might be. And yet I became fully aware, it was not just intellectually, but, you know, experientially, like, wow, she's just like I am. She's no different than me. And that was a big, you know, a big shift in my thinking.
That's awesome. That's a great, by the way, what a wonderful sort of transition for us to go to this next chapter. So here you are, you've had all these wonderful things happen in your life. And I mean, obviously peak physical health, surrounded by beautiful people, you know, traveling the world, and something happens. I mean, you're a new chapter in your life starts. And do you want to describe a little bit of what happened next as far as your health and where you went for a dozen years?
Yeah, so what happened was my dad was transferred to Pennsylvania when I was about going into eighth grade. And so big shift took place. You know, my coach was very, I love him to this day. He's like a father figure to me in many ways. And yet at the same time, in the 80s, people really believed in training over training. And we were supposed to be, like, women in the corporate world were supposed to be like men and dress like men and all that kind of stuff was going on. And so at that time, the East Germans were known to be on steroids. And unfortunately, those females didn't know they were taking steroid pills, but that's what they were given by the doctors. And so in America, we were taught to believe that we were supposed to be as strong and big as they were, even though we were not on drugs. And so body weight was a big issue. And, you know, what we don't see on the TV or in the glamour and hype of all the things that go on with the Olympics is that a lot of people struggle with a lot of other issues like any other normal human being does. And so one big thing that happened for me was I was really forced to, when I turned around 15, my coach started telling me I had to start watching my weight. And I was like, at that point, I always had loved my body. I never really thought much about it. I just thought everything was fine, never even considered an issue. And so he started telling me we're supposed to weigh certain things on the scale, and it became this big, big issue for me as well as many other people. It made me start doubting what's possible within my own self. And around that same time, my parents were separated, and they went through a divorce. And so I was, really kind of my whole family life had kind of crumbled in the sense of having that security. And even though I was traveling the world and doing very, very well, my body was shutting down on me. It was a place where I was getting, overly trained. I was not sleeping enough, probably just from all that. We were up in the morning training at 5:30, getting ready for practice, and then training until late at night, and then coming home, getting homework done. And I was at a private school, and a lot of stuff going on. And it's funny, at the time, I just sort of thought it was normal. I didn't really think anything of it. That's what everybody else around me was doing. I loved what I was doing. I loved going to school. I loved studying. I loved being challenged. I loved all the seeing what was possible. So even like as I got sick, I ended up sick with mononucleosis when I was about 15. I just first went through the same, well, maybe it's because I'm really wanting to socialize more. Maybe I really don't want to swim anymore. Maybe it's not so important to me. And really what was going on for me is I wasn't feeling so great and physically. I really needed some rest. And secondly, I started going, well, geez, I know I've been training really, really hard and I've done really well traveling internationally for the last few years, but I also saw what a fine line it was. You could be a world record holder and not make the team or not go there and medal or whatever it is. And I knew that there's a little bit of luck that goes into all that. You can have all your goals and set and do all the action steps to get you to your level where you want to be, and yet there is no guarantees in the end. And so I kind of started doubting, like, well, is it all worth all this? Here I am sick, and I first have to get healthy now. I got into boys. I wanted to be able to go out and go to parties. And I was going, is it worth it? And then I really went through this period where I had to say, you know what? I can't live with myself if I give up. That's just not who I am. I had to at least be able to push through it and see what I could do. And so that's really the path I took. And luckily for me, I still ended up making, more international trips and winning medals and having a very good career. But I really wasn't healthy for those last few years. And so it was a big shift because when I finally accepted the fact that I was really sick with chronic fatigue syndrome, which was, immune system just basically shutting down on me. I had it took me like a few years to kind of, I was stubborn. I was like, I can do this. I can get well if I will my way through this. And meanwhile, I still wasn't getting well. My body was just inflamed and everything wasn't working. I couldn't think. I got disabled. My doctor finally convinced me to get disabled parking at age 22, and I was in college at Berkeley, and I was just like, I can't, it took me like a year to finally say, okay, I'm willing, I'm ready, I'm ready to surrender to this. And in that time and place, then things really started making a big shift for my life, really. It's like, you wonder, it's like, okay, well, I could have had this whole other career still as an athlete, and yet I really believe the universe had other plans for me. And that's where the will of our mind is so powerful, and yet there is a greater power in place, I really believe.
So, with this, like most obstacles that we face, I know in your book you talk about setbacks and obstacles, and, mm-hmm. and not letting them define you. But this was one of those moments again where it could appear to be on the outside, Olympic athlete who's now has a handicap sticker on her car and parking close to because she can't walk into the building like a normal able-bodied person. But when you look back at this time, it was about 12 years, right, that you were really struggling through this whole process, right?
Yes, yes.
But has it become one of these areas where this has, as you look back, you wouldn't change that for the world? This has become a moment of definition for you?
Oh, absolutely. Because, first of all, a lot of athletes have a hard time stopping. And they don't know when to stop because they don't really know truly when their peak is. And, people, that belief of when that is changes as time goes on. And one good thing is I was forced to stop. And it was really traumatic at first because I really loved being in the water. And I remember going down in the pool and just trying to even swim a length, and I would just be knocked out for a couple of days from doing that even. And, it sounds so silly now, but that's the truth. And so I really had to go, well, who am I really? I'm not all these things that these roles and that other people want to define me as. And I always had kind of fought that anyway. I wanted to be considered normal even though other people didn't see me as normal. And so, it's kind of an interesting process to go through. And then having to surrender was the biggest thing for me because I was a big-time Tony Robbins fan when I was a teenager. And that's when he was just sort of breaking out in the 80s. And I was just so into, like, yes, if I set my mind on this, I can make it happen. And so when that didn't always work, I was going, well, there's something else. There must be something greater at will here that I don't know what it is. And I wasn't, at the time, I wasn't sure. I grew up going to church and all that stuff. And I really, at that time, was thinking I was an atheist. I didn't really believe in God at the time. And I was in this place, what is there? What is going on here? Is it me? Is it something else? And so I really had this spiritual shift take place where I got to see, in performances for me anyway, and many people have described this, when I've had my best performances or best practices, it is as if somebody else is doing it for you. All I am is an instrument and letting things happen through me. And that is the experience. And that is, if you want to call it God or whatever you want to call it, it's that experience of realizing that life can be really simple when you just let the, flow yourself down the river, so to speak. And so once I came to the realization that I am okay, even if I'm sick for the rest of my life, and then if I'm bedridden, like, and I have all these experiences going on physically that are painful, I'm still okay with who I am. And once I had that realization of that true, deep, acceptance of me, then it was like I was just totally freed up. It didn't matter anymore. And ironically, that was a big shift for me to allowing myself to get healthy. And it's allowed me, I was always very fascinated by human development and human potential. But it's taken it to a whole new level now when I work with athletes or people, is that, oftentimes you can tell when somebody's motivated by needing that external validation of who they are, like a medal or a title or money or whatever it is, versus really intrinsically feeling it inside. It's playing, having the fun of, can I do this? Is it possible? Where's this leading me?
You talked about this sort of external validation that people look for. Is that people strive so greatly for this external, whether it's a medal, you said, whether it could be money, you mentioned those things as well. Do you see that a lot? Do you see a lot of people who are kind of appear one way as if they're going for something, but inside there's that kind of emptiness? Is that something you're experiencing a lot?
Yes, and I think I'm sure as you do your motivational, your workshop too, I'm sure you see this. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing, it's one thing I really go into in my book is, even though my book is Be Your Best Without the Stress, and I talk a lot about peak potential and how to really go after finding what really truly motivates you. But the bigger message of the book is, how do you find your true self? Because in the end, that's what we're all really seeking, is how do we get immersed so much in what we love to do and stay committed to that, even in those moments of doubt and fear, that we stay on that path. And in those moments, like when I've had my best races or performances or, talking with people or whatever it is, it's in those moments where when we're immersed in what we're doing, that is life. That is, we're totally engaged. There is no other. There is no me, you, what's the difference? We're all the same. It's we see that, like, if I'm in the water's moving me. I'm with the water. It's not separate. And at that point, I believe there's no ego involvement. And when the ego's gone, it's kind of like getting into a deep meditative state. That's so blissful. That is it. We're not the subconscious is taken over. The cognitive mind with all the rationality going on is gone. We're able to be in the moment and see everything really super clearly. And that is, like, to me, that is the ultimate of life, is being so engaged in what we're doing that we get to that place.
Can I ask you a question? I think about people around the world right now listening in to the show. And, there are people who maybe are struggling to say that they found that place. And because they're comparing themselves to, let's say, an Olympic athlete, or they're comparing themselves to a movie star or a musician or something else like that. And they see what they perceive to be success. My question is, do you feel that in these circumstances, is there a way for people who are sitting in that moment, who have this self-doubt about, you know, who they are, how do they take that first step? What is that first step for them?
I think the first step for them is to realize that all of us have unique gifts and talents to offer in this world. It's important to honor what we love to do. And it could be going back to when we're 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old and seeing what we're drawn to. And honor that, because, like, let's say I'm an artist, but my parents really want me to be a doctor. But yet I know I don't want to be a doctor or an accountant or whatever it might be that they're doing. And it's really important to honor me. And that's where I talk a little bit about my book. I have a few chapters where I talk about taking care of yourself and also really shedding the armor that we all tend to carry. It's important to protect ourselves out there in the world and not just totally, you know, be totally open all the time to everybody, because, you know, sometimes there are people out there who are not safe to be around. And yet at the same time, when we honor and trust ourselves enough, we can drop that baggage and take care of ourselves on a deeper level and then open our hearts up to allow good things to come to us and be able to be open to support from other people too. And so I say this because it's easy to think, it's easy to think of an Olympian or a CEO or a movie star or somebody special. And that's what media does. But in the end, we're all normal. We're all human beings who, you know, everybody has, I remember reading a quote from Brad Pitt saying something to the effect of, you know, just because I have lots of money now and I've hit the lotto technically in terms of being a famous actor, I still have, it comes with its own, you know, level of problems too. And, you know, everybody has, we're human, you know, we're all dealing with the ego that likes to struggle rather than getting to that place where everything is there's no polarity, there's no duality, and we're going to integrate it all into one moment.
Well, you know, I want to interrupt you on just for a second if I can. You know, you talked a little bit about those Russian athletes and how the body image of the American girls was put into question, is that, you know, you had to be a certain way. So, and when we look at the eating disorders throughout North America, let's say throughout the world, but certainly within North America, I know some of the stats. I mean, it's horrendous how many girls, you know, are comparing themselves to magazines and body types and really struggling in that arena. Is that right?
Oh, gosh, yes, absolutely. Because you look at a magazine and, you know, you and I know that those people have been touched up and made to look a certain way on the cover. And meanwhile, if you were to meet them in person, they don't even look the same. And so what happens is all these poor young people around the world are looking at these pictures thinking, I'm supposed to look like this, but I can't. And then they get mad at themselves. And then we get on that perfection cycle, which is like, I'm going to try to be perfect. I'm not going to eat any of this or that. And then I'm going to go and try this. And then it works for a while. And then stress starts to build inside. And the next thing we know, we eventually explode and have several ice cream sodas or sundaes or pizzas or whatever it is that you enjoy eating. And then you feel good for that moment, like, oh, I have a release. And then it's the next moment you're like, oh, I feel like crap. I did it again. And now I'm going to gain weight or whatever it is for people. And then you go through that whole cycle. It can be drinking. It can be sex. It can be working too much. It can be, you know, whatever. And in the end, it's like, what is perfection? And that's one thing that I think a lot of people struggle with, even if they think they're not perfectionists. All of us are trying to be good enough. And in the end, we have to realize, hey, I'm good enough in this moment. No matter what's happened up until now, I'm in a place where I can really just say, you know what, I forgive myself for my mistakes. I forgive others for around me. And those things don't have to define me. Those things have happened up until now, but they help define what I want to do with myself in my life. But I get to decide. And I think it's important for people by me being honest with, you know, people who read my book, I hope that I'll encourage others to open themselves up and trust the process of exploring their own personal journeys to be true to who they really are. Because in the end, if we can awaken to lost aspects of ourselves and become more aware of our impact and importance in the world, we can commit to decisive actions that help us and to be on our path.
Well, in your book, you talk, you know, you have specific strategies that you encompass in the book. You know, and again, I want to remind people of the title, How to Become Your Best Without the Stress. And obviously, you know, when we're talking here about our best, I mean, our best then is a personal joy. I love that when you talked about swimming, where you sort of say you become with the water. When you're in a place of absolute bliss, where you're connecting to something that's so deeply passionate, time and space does fall away. I mean, I've experienced that, and I think a lot of people listening have experienced that. But are you finding the more you step into these strategies that you've written about in your book, the more you have that experience, like on a day-to-day basis, whether you're with your children or whether you're with your husband or whether you're working or writing, do you find that you'll have that same experience like you do with the water, where you feel
yes,
like...
Yes, absolutely. And I think we all can tap into that every day. I really believe that everybody has experienced that, at least when they were babies or at some point. it's a matter of tapping back into that source of great energy that we all have inside of us and realizing that, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in approval out there or needing to control things or figure things out or trying to get some sense of security in our lives. And in the end, that's all our ego stuff. And I really feel like the more we can go beyond that and tap into, you know, getting more focused so that we can get go, I really believe getting beyond the conscious mind, getting into the subconscious, letting that take over so that we can see the connection, like look out the, you look out a window and see the connection to the earth or connect to somebody who you're talking to and be in a place where you really can be one and immersed with people and really see the light in each person. You know, and know that we all have gifts to offer. And even somebody who's been a serial killer, they underneath that, they have a lot of, they underneath that, they're still a human being. There's something in them that made them trigger to do these terrible, awful things. But they also, too, can also be healed.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I totally agree with that. I mean, when you, and you sort of talk about that light, you know, obviously discovering the light in others is one thing, but discovering the light in ourselves. Can we go through, you've got so many great strategies. Can we go through some of the more important ones? Because obviously someone wants to get all of them. They're going to have to read the book and we won't be able to cover them all. But what are some of the more important ones in your book that you feel if someone was listening right now?
The first thing I'd probably do is, you know, the biggest thing I think is, if people get scared of feeling good, we're used to beating ourselves up in our head mentally. And that first thing is going to sound simple and silly. But you just look up at the ceiling or sky and put a big grin on your face and smile. And when you do that, all of a sudden you do that for like, it changes your physiological state. You do that for 15 seconds, it alters your whole emotional state, which allows you to look at an issue that you may be dealing with in a totally different way. So one, you need to get I really believe in getting yourself into a positive state. However you do that, sometimes you can do visualization. I share some meditation tips. But a simple way is just literally standing up, looking up, putting your arms to the sky, or even just screaming yes up into the world and putting a big grin on your face. And it's funny, my husband and I, we work with athletes, we do this all, literally just did this yesterday with a bunch of athletes because, you know, and sometimes it's awkward. We're afraid of somebody watching us or thinking that we're silly or whatever. But when we do this, we feel good inside. We feel the energy flow through us. When the energy's flowing from there, we have a much better willingness to try something new. From there, I have an exercise I like to call the magic wand, where, you know, my daughter likes to wish upon the stars every night and have these wishes come true. And I, you know, it's kind of a funny thing because the innocence of that is so pure. And yet at the same time, when we let go of our own fears, if we were to allow ourselves to have exactly what we really wanted, if we were granted that wish, what would it be for ourselves? And when we can just write for several minutes nonstop like that, let the subconscious take over and write down all the dreams and wishes we might have. What comes from us is we get kind of excited, like, well, wouldn't that be cool? Wouldn't that be nice? We may have some resistance come up, too. I talk a little bit about this in my book, but you can release the resistance. We're in a place where we can say, okay, I'm noticing I'm a little bit nervous about being successful here. Okay, can I let that go? Can I let the tension go? Let the tension, as I exhale it out. And there's ways to go about doing that. So as we're going through the wishes, we can really feel, allow ourselves to really appreciate who we are, that we're allowed to be able to do wonderful things in this world. There's no one, nothing can stop us. And being in a place, initially we may think circumstances out there, we can be victims to that. But instead we can get to choose, no, I don't need to react to all those. This thing may be happening in my neighborhood or my school or my city or my job, but I can change, I can choose to live differently. And it takes a little bit of guts, but that's why it's really important to build the courage up and feeling good within yourself first. Set some simple goals and action steps, which I lay out in my book too, about actually how you can take these simple steps, and then when you follow through on what you say you're going to do on a daily basis, you trust yourself. You trust that when you say you'll do something, you'll do it. And that leads to bigger, bigger visionary ideas as well. And so just taking those first steps will be a big, big plus. But then I know we all get stuck. And so going into the unconscious, I think, is a very important thing. And so I have several chapters where I give tools for that. But something I can simply just share on the radio here is paying attention to your emotional state. Are you getting too attached to needing this to happen? Are you really like it's going to, you feel like it's a life or death thing? If it feels too much like a life or death thing, we need to back off and be observing ourselves a little bit. Have compassion for yourself for where you're at and why you need these certain things to happen, but also know that you need to back off enough to allow it to happen because otherwise it'll build enough resistance around it. It's harder for it to happen. And being open to asking for help from others. If there's somebody in your field that you want to be in who's done something you already want to do, collapse the time it takes to get there by asking for advice from them. And you know, I lay out many other tools as well, but I think the biggest thing is, you know, getting in touch with the self and the confidence we all have that we have within ourselves and harnessing that power
But the practice of that, and that, this is a really good point, how, you know, we see people who start New Year's resolutions every year, and, you know, by January 5th or 6th, you know, they're already waning on that. And by, you know, at the end of the month, they've forgotten about it altogether. So this trust of self to continue on, trust of self to start this journey. Let's say they get your book and they start working through these exercises to, you know, discover that self. That self-awareness, yes. That authenticity, that self-love, that, but it's a process. I mean, it's not something for some people, and you, obviously you've worked with people that have, and you've experienced it for 12 years where you had to mentally and physically and emotionally find a way out of that, the valley that you were in, right?
Yes. Well, that's the big thing I was going to mention too, is that knowing it's okay to have a bad day or moment or hour or months. It's okay to have that, and so, and you're not the only one. You're not alone out there. You know that there's other people who can be there with you. You can supported by. And the biggest thing is commit to something, commit to who you are for number one. But really get really clear on what truly motivates you. And I give a lot more exercises in the book that people can actually just take a notebook and write and do some journal exercises. But in terms of getting clear what that means, because initially it's okay initially if you want to get that new car. That might be what was really motivating you right now, or somebody who wants to get a medal or a title, and that might be enough for now. But then when you get that, you'll realize that that really isn't what you're really seeking. And so as time goes on, you'll get deeper and deeper within yourself and see that there's something much greater that you've been seeking all along that's actually inside of you the whole time too.
And so for you, I mean, going from where you were at, again, as a competitive athlete at the very, very height of your game, you know, internationally renowned as well. In fact, I remember watching you swim. I remember those Olympics. But with that sort of the valley coming down, as you started to get clearer on what you wanted and you started doing these exercises, because obviously this book is born out of your own experience. This is born from your own inner journey. That's where most books are created. And obviously, yes. You know, you've helped a lot of people move from where they're at to where they want to be in their life. Is there your passions now, how have they changed from being in the pool and competing? What is the passion now that you've unlocked since you've started doing this work?
I love watching people unfold and be blossom into who they are. I just love seeing that unfold, the process of that. And so, you know, for example, I've worked with thousands of different people and from all different ages, types, ethnicities, everything. And in the end, when people can kind of be brave enough to be loving themselves, I mean, I know that sounds so cliche-ish, and I don't want to be new agey here. It's not that at all. It's about, initially I used to think, oh, that's so selfish. I'm not supposed to do that. It's okay to appreciate who you are, approve of who you are, even if your parents didn't agree with what you're doing. That's okay. You know, that's part of the beauty of life is that even in a relationship, you know, it's important to honor the other person for who they are and come to some compromise in terms of maybe working together, you know, but at the same time, it's important to honor each other. And I feel like once we can validate who we are and get more clear on what that feels like for ourselves, we feel good. Most people feel really good. And at first, we may not want to be, like, maybe we feel awkward, or maybe some of us feel like we love to study and be, some people call us nerds. Well, who cares? Love being the nerd, you know? Take it on and enjoy it. And I'm serious about that because, you know, I used to get teased because I swam so much, but I love being in the water. And if I had to give that up to get approval from somebody else who couldn't even never give me approval, I'd be still looking for it. Whereas I was able to jump in the water and give it to myself.
Some of your strategies are around self-approval. I know you talk about self-affirmations in your book and your brag book. I love this brag book idea. Do you want to talk a couple of those? Because those are real key strategies when someone's trying to really, you know, approve of self without the external approval, which again is can be incredibly challenging for many people.
Yes, it was hard for me initially too, because I was taught to believe that in order to be at my best, I had to beat myself up mentally and tell myself I had to do more and better and harder and all that kind of stuff. And it's funny, even like a couple of kids I was working with yesterday who were teenagers, they were thinking, well, I need to work harder, I need to do more because I'm doing well, but I want to do better. And I'm like, well, actually, I can tell that what you needed to do to go home is probably take a day off and get some rest. And they're like, but I don't know what to do with that. I don't know what to do. I'd be sitting still and go crazy. And I'm like, that's okay. Your body's telling me you need rest. And it's scary for us to stop.
Yeah.
It's scary for us to get off the treadmill and do nothing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yet in those moments, that's where the new ideas come from.
Awesome. So talk a little bit about those self-affirmations and brag book. Just mention.
Sure, yeah. So the brag book is a simple exercise. Basically, I really believe in having a notebook. I like that. I have mine by my bedside. I have it in my drawer. And I take it out and write down ideas. I mean, it could be as simple as, you know, maybe I'm just going to make some things up here for people. It could be, you know what? I tend to keep my room messy and I'm going to start making my bed every day. I made my bed today. You write that down and you feel good about it. And then it could be as simple as I went to work today and I didn't want to go to work. I was feeling kind of lousy. But then I ended up having this great experience, this interaction with somebody that went really well. Or I had a sale take place that I didn't know was going to go through. It could be as simple as I worked out today after not having worked out for many months. It could be I went to the gym and I was able to do so much more of something that I've been trying to do than I could last time. It could be I gave myself an approval shower. I'm really a firm believer in just allowing approval to come down on my body and allow myself to just feel good about myself. It could be
Whoa. Go back to that approval shower. I kind of like that. Talk about that a little bit more. Approval shower. How do you have an approval shower?
Okay. So pretend like, you know, you look at babies. Everybody loves babies, whether they're spitting up or throwing up or pooping or whatever it is, right? And people just love the baby. And it's the same idea. Why can't we give ourselves that same kind of love now, no matter what's going on in our world? And so approval, if you just imagine you're sitting in the shower, and instead of the water coming out of the faucet, it's like rays of sunshine beaming down through your head, all the way through your heart, into your stomach, into your body, all through your organs, out to your feet. And you can feel that. The energy of that, the power of the sun. If we didn't have the sun, there would be no other in this world. We probably wouldn't be here. And so that if you feel that, you can initially feel like just the light and the heat of a sunshine beaming down on you as if you were on a beach or something, and then start telling, you know, allowing yourself to feel approval, like as if you were just being given lots of love. If you, maybe it means you might imagine yourself being a star on a stage and everybody just sending you lots of love and adoring you. It could be you just, you know, getting a massage and being touched. It could be, you know, there's so many ways you can experience it. It could be if you'd like to talk to yourself in your head, it could be you actually telling yourself that I love myself for who I am. I'm allowing myself to have this wonderful day today. I'm allowing myself to feel loved by all these people around me. I'm allowing myself not to feel judgment. I'm allowing myself just to feel good. And, you know, just allowing them as a water, you don't have to even say anything. Like, I'm more of a kinesthetic person, so I don't like to talk too much about it. I like just to feel it as if the water's coming down and just sending me love through my body.
Awesome. An approval shower. I approve of the approval shower.
That's all. So you don't have to be in the shower to do it. You can do it anywhere.
Yeah. You do it out in the. I was out hiking up in the mountains yesterday, and I had a few moments like that. I mean, but obviously having these triggers. I mean, knowing that there's something you can call it something. An approval shower. I like that. I'm standing there. I'm on top of a mountain, and I've been hiking up there all day in deep snow. You know, and I was like, and I was just like sweating, but I felt so alive. And in that moment, would have been a perfect thing for me to have that analogy. An approval shower right now, ladies and gentlemen. Here I go.
Well, you can just bring your arms up to the sky, feel the sunshine come down, bring your fingers, like just have them come on slightly touch the top of your head, and you just imagine them going all the way down to your feet.
Why do you think self-love and self-approval and everything we're talking about, and obviously everything, all my work, at the end of the day, what it always comes down to is this self-approval and self-love. Why is it so challenging in our society? You would think with the evolution of mankind that we'd actually be at a place where everyone would be evolving into this self-love and awareness, but it seems like we're moving further away from it, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, it's kind of a funny thing, isn't it? Because I personally think that, you know, we study quantum physics, you know, look at a lot of stuff that's gone on in terms of, you know, science or looking at what people study. Can we get beyond living in duality? This is one thing that I don't have the answer to yet, but I do question it. How long can I stay in a meditative state where I have no ego? And as you watch babies, they have egos and needs already too. And so I do think, when my own experience anyway, when I'm in that blissful place, there is no duality going on. There's no polarity. There's no good, bad, or whatever. You know, it's all one. And so, but then out of that emerges another duality, and from that duality you integrate into oneness again. That's my own perspective anyway. And so I'm not sure, can we as human beings stay in a oneness state 24/7? I don't know. But I like to believe that we can be there for many hours. I know I've been there for hours. And but to say I've been in that state for days and months, no, I can't say that. But it is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating that it hasn't become, or it's not really taught at school. You know, it's like financial literacy isn't taught at school. You know, self-love is not taught at school. And I that's a crazy thing. And it, when all of the challenges that most people have later on in life, whether they're financially successful or not, you know, that when you're full, I think when the heart is full, then, you know, there's a sense of bliss. And I think that's what a lot of the, I use the word bliss quite often, you know, but I'm hearing you speak. I feel like you live in bliss a lot, and the strategies that you have help people achieve that as well, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I feel like even if there's something that other people might perceive as something not great, I can still, I'm not attached to it. So I do live in that place a lot, like where I don't need to be so caught up in something that's going on around, like, you know, it could be in the news or whatever. And I feel compassion. Like, you know, recently I read that whole thing about the India with the girl being raped and getting killed, died. And it's very sad. I feel the sadness of the country and the people and all that stuff. And yet I also know that I don't have to make it a drama in my own world.
Right.
And it's important to, you know, I
well, there's a distinction in what you just said, and I don't want people to miss this, because I remember that story as well, and it's horrific. The girl on the bus,
yeah.
Right? Is that the girl
yeah,
on the bus?
It, yeah, it is horrific.
You
yeah.
know, and so she's on a public bus, and she's raped, and I mean, and it's horrific. And so what you're saying, though, is there's this sense of empathy and a sense of sadness and a sense of understanding that you have for what's going on.
The perpetrator and the victim. I mean, that's the whole point, you know. You know, it's funny. At one time in my life, I lived on John DuPont's estate. He trained. He had a place called Team Foxcatcher in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I might be getting a little bit off topic. So you just pull me in if I'm getting too far off.
No, just carry on.
Anyhow,
carry on.
He was a very, obviously, we know DuPont family is very well-to-do, and he actually had a 50-meter pool on his properties. Well, long story short, many athletes lived and trained there, and for swimming, we actually swam there in Philadelphia area when I was in high school there. And he ended up shooting and killing one of the wrestlers. He was a paranoid schizophrenic, and rightfully so. If I look at his background, he was always wanted for things for his money and then sued for his money. It was always the same. So he was paranoid, and rightfully so. Meanwhile, though, he couldn't get close to people. And so what ends up happening is he ended up killing Dave Schultz, a wrestler, out of this whole thing. But meanwhile, I know DuPont, and I also knew Dave Schultz. And I understand them. I understand. I mean, not that it makes it right, but I understand, you know, what motivated him to do it. Even though, you know, it's not like, and that's the whole weird thing when you start looking at society. You know, why do people do these awful things?
What you're saying, though, which I think is very, very important. I mean, people who have been hurt by their family. I know I did a lot of forgiveness work when I was sort of, you know, going through my own sort of journey of discovery, because, you know, I was pretty angry growing up. So what I realized was, when I looked at my mom specifically and my father and the anger and the stuff I was holding on to, when I started to look at their story and why they did the things they did and put myself in their position, I came out with this understanding, look, everyone does the best they can at the time with what they have and with
their journey.
So what you're talking about there is really looking at a person and saying, well, you know, yeah, they may have done a bad thing, but the journey to that bad moment, there's, if we can elevate ourselves beyond the action and we see a human being, we can see, like, Adolf Hitler or anybody else who's done these atrocities.
Yeah, but there's a lot of pain there.
A lot of pain, right. So
I think that's what's more important for, as a society, we need to focus on. If I can do something to heal my own stuff so that I can be more of service and there for other people to be true to who they are, and if we can do that as a world and connect and hold hands around the world, I know that's an image that we can hold in our minds and our hearts. It also ultimately alters what can happen in our consciousness in this world.
Awesome. And in your book, you talk about forgiveness and letting go as being a key part of that journey as well, right?
Yes, I'm a firm believer. I've done it, like you said, I've done that same kind of work, and it's so powerful, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, essential is that, I mean, there's a great, I love this saying, you know, when you're holding on to anger or hatred or anything else, it's like drinking poison and expecting somebody else to die. You know, so a lot of people don't get that, you know, your book, by the way, the steps in your book, if someone was to practice these steps, then the life will open up in many, many ways. The way we see the world, the way we interact with the world, but the way we interact with ourselves, which is really what I get from your book, is this sort of this journey of self-love and how that journey actually impacts the world around you, right?
Yes, because once we change our inside, it changes our outside. I mean, people have probably heard that phrase before, but it's so true. Is the more, so initially I used to think, oh, like, I have to get this person to respond a certain way to me. And it's like, well, no, all I have to do is give what I'm looking for outside of me. I just have to give it to myself. And if I can do that, it's going to alter what's going on around me anyway. And it's funny, in my own life with people, I have done that where I've changed how I respond and react to others, and therefore it changes my relationship with them.
Awesome.
For the better, and, you know, to the point where all of a sudden I'm no longer fazed by the stuff that used to bother me. And they feel better too, usually. And so when we come from a higher place, we all end up winning, don't we?
Well, what I love about what you just said there is this whole idea of victimhood, right? And when we're a pinball, you know, in a machine of life and getting pinged from one sort of emotion to the other from all these external forces that are pushing us around. And when we elevate ourselves above that, which I feel that you teach beautifully, you write about beautifully, and obviously you live that life as well, that you're living beyond that. But having the understanding of when people are, this is going to be a bit graphic, when people are puking out their own insecurities, their own negativity, their own on us, we don't have to be a victim of that. We can actually understand that, and actually by staying in this place, by finding that place of self-love, we can actually impact the people around us even without saying words, right?
Oh, absolutely. I agree 100%. And to another level, which I'll just bring up as we're talking about this, is, you know, for in athletics, for example, or in work world or whatever it is, we can actually imagine an energy, like a ball around us, you know, where we can protect our energy. Like, we all have an energy field that comes off of our bodies to a certain, you know, several feet for some people, or less or more. And if we feel somebody trying to come into our space and suck our energy, which literally, you know, some people say that there are people out there that do that. You know, everybody has different beliefs on that. But I really believe that when people are trying to get energy from somebody else to feel better about themselves, even if it's not positive, we have the ability to shield off that so we don't take it on. And literally just have it bounce back to them so that they may be able to respond to their own stuff.
Awesome. Well, you know, we're getting to the end of the show here. I have a question for you. And I'm going to, at the end of the show, I'm going to share with people how they can find your book, where they can go.
Sure.
But I want you to just, the show's called The Kick-Ass Life. And you know, everyone has a different definition of what that means. So if I ask you, what does it mean to lead a kick-ass life? How would you describe that?
To be fully engaged, living every day.
There you go. That's the shortest version and very impactful. I love it.
Yeah, well, it's kind of true, though, isn't it? Because in the end, if that's what we're all looking for. We're all looking to be able to say, how can I be engaged in what I'm doing? How can I be, when we're present in it? That is what that is, kick-ass.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, we haven't mentioned it, but I know I want to. I know you and your husband are very, very engaged in the fitness world, and you have a new fitness series come out, DVDs, The 7 Ultimate Fitness Routines.
Yes, and that is.
Yeah, yeah. And
thank
so,
you.
No, I just want to mention that is that, you know, as you transcended this journey, these 12 years, well, obviously your success, the 12 years of that real deep learning, and now as you've come out of it, the work with your book, and then obviously to help help kids. Yeah, I know you do a lot of work with kids, a lot of work with athletes, where you're helping them really truly discover this way of living a kick-ass life, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I would love to be in a place where you and I go do a workshop around the world together with corporate people, retired people, young people. It'd be fun to do.
You are on. All right, let's do it.
Because a lot, you know, we all want to be engaged and feel this. We can do some stuff with people in a room and be more experiential and really go through it.
Absolutely. Well, I do believe in immersion. I think immersion, if you want to accelerate the speed to of your journey, then when we immerse ourselves in those environments, we do accelerate. It's like putting your foot on the gas, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, if people want to find out where my DVD and the books, they're available either at katrinaradke.com, that's KatrinaRadke, or on Amazon and many other places as well.
Yeah, and I'll repeat that at the end of the show for you as well. But Katrina, you know, we're at that time. I'd love to keep chatting, and I'm going to have you back on the show. It's wonderful, and congratulations on a beautiful life that you've created, and through the highs and the lows. And I know you have two amazing kids, and I know that you're a dedicated wife, a dedicated mom, and dedicated to passion. And I think, you know, and authenticity. And I think that's a wonderful balance. So thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, David.
This is the Olympic theme song from London last year. The Big Ben. Those of you who have been to London, Big Ben on the Thames. Of course, I am from England originally, so. But, you know, great lessons. So many great, great things that we can take into our life, actually use the tips that she really has that are so, so usable. And, you know, I really like so many of them, it really is about that whole idea about authenticity. And I'm always in that place of, you know, finding that authentic place inside of ourselves, that place we were born to be, not the place we have learned to be. And so, you know, I love the brag book. I think that's a really cool little thing, you know, and it's so hard to really, in our society, to be saying great things about ourselves and, you know, self-affirmations, you know, and, you know, not letting your setbacks define you, which is really a part of her message. And she talks about that in her book, you know. But so many wonderful, wonderful little gems in that book. And again, if you want to get the book, you can go to our website, thekickasslife.com, and you can go through on Amazon, through our little Amazon button on the right-hand side there. And that helps the show out a little bit as well. And of course, don't forget the fitness DVDs that her and her wonderful husband have put together, the 7 ultimate fitness routines. And if you haven't been to, you know, if you look at Katrina right now, she's just hitting 40 and she's looking good and she knows how to look after herself and her family. And she really, she shared with me how much her family means to her and how they made real choices to create space for her and her family to really love on these children as they're growing up. So, and now she's really sort of stepping out and bringing that message to the world. So, that was a wonderful to spend time with you, Katrina. I look forward to our emerging friendship. I know it's happening, and I again, everyone out there, you know, it's not a question of listening to these shows. It's a question of what's the one thing you can take into your life? Because I mean, you can change everything. That's going to be monumental. But the one thing you hear that you got it. I can use that. I'm taking it into my life. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, again, we've got a busy time coming up, and I will be talking to you before I leave. I don't leave till next Tuesday, but then I'm going to be on the road for about 3 weeks, and I'll be bringing you shows from around around the world, different people, different sounds. I wish we had little smell recorders where you can have the smells as well. Maybe not my feet after, 7 days on a mountain with no baths, but everything else would be awesome. So with that said, I will see you on the other side. Don't forget, get your Katrina's book. Great reading, great tips. She's earned her stripes both at the very, very top of her game and, of course, going through the valleys and coming back through the peaks as she has. So I will see you, ladies and gentlemen, on the other side.
That was kick-ass.